Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hey, OCD family community. We are less than 1 week from Hanukkah and Christmas, and less than 2 weeks from 2025. Ugh, I don't know about you, but that puts me in a state of anxiety based on all the things I still need to get done. But today, we're taking a deeper dive into anxiety sensitivity, which is different than both state or trait anxiety. And while it can be prevalent in OCD, it's not unique to OCD. Curious to learn more? I hope you are, fam, because as it turns out, curiosity can be key, and I can't wait to share more.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent, and let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Alrighty, fam. So my kiddos just wrapped up their final week of school before Christmas break. A special thanks to all the teachers, the real heroes, that have made it this far, and for all you do for our precious kiddos. In fact, my kiddos are going to stick around and even help me out a little bit later in today's intrusive thought segment. But first, fam, I couldn't forget about you. And I definitely couldn't forget about today's special return guest expert, Mr. Carl Robbins, LCPC. Carl is the director of training at ASDI, which is the Anxiety and Stress Disorders Institute of Maryland, where he is also a senior clinician. He is on the faculty at the University of Maryland Department of Psychiatry. He has been treating OCD and related disorders for over 35 years. And he is a mentee of Dr. Sally Winston, which you'll hear more about just a little later in today's conversation. He's attended multiple trainings through the IOCDF, ADAA, and AVCT over his long career. He has also presented at the IOCDF and ADA and ADAA conferences to both consumers and professionals. More recently, he has done individual training with Dr. Fred Ardema, PhD, co-developer of inference-based CBT, otherwise known as ICBT for OCD. Carl is committed to promoting the dissemination of ICBT in the U.S. through consultation, teaching, lectures, social media, and podcasts. Holla! And fam, we are better for it. But as if that's not impressive enough, Carl, I just have to note, was recently named the recipient of the 2025 Geralyn Ross Clinician Advocate Award by the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. That's ADAA. This is a well-deserved achievement that honors both the memory and life work of Geralyn Ross, who was ADAA's co-founder and president for 25 years, as well as Carl for his excellence and outstanding advocacy for patient education, care, training, and research. And fam, I have no doubt that after hearing today's chat, it will be obvious why he was the perfect pick for such an honor. So without further ado, let's go ahead and dive in, because there's lots of learning and hope ahead, fam. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, and we have a return guest, and this is a treasure because many people, especially within our treatment community, but also if you've been to conferences like ADAA or past conferences for IOCDF, different trainings that have been available and accessible virtually, especially since COVID and just the farther reach of all of that, we have Carl Robbins with us today. And Carl, I'm so excited to have you here back with the fam. Welcome.
Great to be here. I'm really looking forward to talking about this very important topic.
Yes, this is going to be a really interesting, fascinating, important topic. And you know what, fam? This extends outside of OCD. It's experienced within OCD for many folks. But this is a topic that transcends just one diagnosis, or even a person that may not be at a disordered level may have a very familiar experience with this. And the topic today is on anxiety sensitivity. And so, Carl, you reached out to me, gosh, it was probably better part of a year ago, maybe 6 months ago. And you said, this is such an important topic. And I was like, yes, I would love if we could talk about this with the fam. So when we talk about anxiety sensitivity, we're going to address what it is not. But I would love to know, if you're so inclined to share, what your personal interest is or history with this topic, really how it became a part of your focus and treatment and understanding it better.
Sure. Yeah, I like to say that I was born in the Jurassic period when dinosaurs roamed the earth in terms of treatment for OCD and anxiety disorders. Mm-hmm. So I'm now in my early 70s. And my personal experience with anxiety sensitivity goes back to my junior year of college. Mm-hmm. And I was visiting my brother, who was in medical school at the time. I myself was a pre-med junior at an Ivy League college. I was a Division I athlete, so I had a lot going for me.
Yeah.
And just to let people know that, you know, that panic and OCD is an equal opportunity challenge.
Yeah.
And so I was visiting my brother, and this is February 10th, 1973. Mm-hmm. So I remember not only the day, I remember where I was. I was sitting in University of Rochester Medical School Library, and I was ruminating like hell. In mm-hmm. retrospect, I realized I was ruminating like hell, and it was about, do I want to go to medical school, about my career, about my athletic career, about my social life? And there was also, in retrospect, a lot of existential OCD going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I got the sort of meaning of life, and I had gotten into Buddhism. And so ruminating like crazy, and suddenly there's a snap, and I feel what I now know was intense depersonalization and derealization. Depersonalization is a sense that you're sort of out of your body. Derealization is a sense that things don't feel quite real. There's a sort of a spacey unreality to the way things appear and seem. And, you know, it's interesting. Let me just say, as an aside, what I've learned recently is that there was a really interesting paper recently out of Israel that showed that rumination is a precursor to depersonalization and derealization.
Interesting.
And which is a really fascinating idea and relevant for those of us in the OCD community, because we all know that rumination is a central part for OCD for lots of people. And there's some interesting sort of explanations for it. It's sort of like when you're up in your head and you sort of come back to the present moment, there can be this sort of sense of detachment. And one thought I've had, and I've actually seen this, is that in existential OCD, there's so much rumination that goes on about the big questions.
Right.
And then if that leads to derealization, like things don't feel quite real, that can in turn feed more rumination about the nature of reality, which can feed more derealization. And I've actually seen some cases recently that I better understand about this interaction between rumination and derealization. So that's another show.
I'm abstracting that because it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah. I invite people to explore. It's a fascinating paper and idea. Anyway, I have these weird, basically, sensations. And my thought is, oh, my God, I'm going crazy. Which is a very common interpretation of depersonalization, derealization.
Right.
So I get my brother to take me to the emergency room, and I meet with this resident who basically sort of, I remember him not being very empathic and basically yelling at me. And he then proceeds to give me antipsychotics.
Oh, man.
And these are the old antipsychotics. This is the early 70s.
The first generation.
The first generation.
Yeah.
And I think he gave me Meloril. So So
this made you spiral out more.
So, you know, I take this, which makes me feel even weirder.
Right.
Which makes me even more afraid. And this is the self-amplifying nature of anxiety sensitivity. I mean, we'll define it more specifically in a little while. And then that created a cascade. I ended up dropping out of school, and there was a whole odyssey that's a story for another time. But in retrospect, what did I need in that moment? What I needed more than anything else was information.
Right.
Which what I needed to hear was, oh, you're experiencing something called depersonalization, derealization.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a very uncomfortable feeling. It is not a sign of impending insanity or losing control. And this can be the result of either ruminating or hyperventilation or intense anxiety. And this will pass. And in fact, just to help you get through this crisis, here's a little Valium.
Yeah,
a little benzo. I don't think they even had a little benzo. Right.
Yeah.
And so there's an important point I want to make there, you know, and we can return to it, which is that there's this idea that a lot of clinicians get that reassurance is a compulsion, right? And that is concerning. Of course, reassurance, like anything, can turn into a compulsion, that if it's repetitive, that if it's used as a safety behavior, that if it's interfering with relationships, of course, it's problematic. But anything can be dismissed.
Can function that way.
Yeah. By the way, exposure can be used compulsively. So I think that's important. And then, in fact, providing information is a really important part of treating anxiety sensitivity. Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So,
Carl, can I pause you there too? Because I love that you're saying that. And I think so many family members listening are like, yeah, as we learn more about OCD more broadly, or these different OCRDs, or just even different traits like anxiety sensitivity, a lot of the feedback that the family learns is, oh, everything I've been doing is reassuring. I'm just trying to love my person. And now I realize that I've been accommodating OCD. And there are times where that can happen. Like you said, it can function in compulsive ways. But also, we can also provide our brains information, and that initial reassurance that provides information to the brain is different. We understand that to be different. And it's not that any information is bad, is probably the better way to say it. And I think that's a really good message for family members to hear that are feeling that guilt about, oh my gosh, I've just totally screwed everything up, and all I was trying to do was love my person. And so there is an important difference in understanding when something is functioning in a compulsive way and when it's just providing the brain information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just because something happens to be comforting doesn't mean that it's compulsive.
Right.
As somebody, I think Drew Insalata has made the distinction between assurance and reassurance. So it's the problem is the re part, right? The repetitive part, not the A part, not the assurance part. So it's such an important idea. You know, and by the way, just providing psychoeducation about what OCD is, of what an obsession is, what a compulsion is, can be quite comforting. Sally Winston talks all the time about the role of bewilderment in OCD, and just sort of understanding how it works can be quite comforting and make people sort of less afraid of what's going on in their head. So
yeah.
So I think that we all do it to some extent, and we need not be so afraid as clinicians. Which brings me to another part, yeah. Which is that on this topic of anxiety sensitivity, when I asked my colleagues how many people had ever heard of it, let alone learned about it in graduate school, it's amazing how few people are taught, you know, learn about OCD in graduate school.
Yeah.
You know? And if somebody's looking for a doctoral dissertation out there, that would be a good one.
That would be a great one.
Good one.
Actually, I think Laura Smithson, I was BTTI trained with her, and I think part of her doctoral dissert is trying to understand the master's level and above, or lack thereof, education around OCD. So she's one person that kind of light bulbed in my brain when you said that. And we could use more of that because it is super important. One thing, too, I want to kind of add, and we're going to get in next to what anxiety sensitivity is and what it's not. But I have in my brain as well And I'm mindful of Madison at Obsessively Strong, one of our fellow colleagues, talks a lot and runs a social media account to raise awareness and understanding and advocacy around OCD. And she has struggled a lot with DPDR, which is depersonalization, derealization. And I'm just thinking, as you're talking about this, about how she's talked about, you know, I think the source of DPDR is often aversion of sensory motor OCD. And I feel like that aligns a lot with what we think about when we think of anxiety sensitivity. And so I certainly don't want to cut you off if you weren't through sharing your personal history, but it's one of those questions that I would love to chat more about as we get into what is anxiety sensitivity, what is it not?
Yeah, just the other part of my personal story is that in, is it 40 years ago, I met Sally Winston. A lot of people in the community have heard of Sally. Sally actually became my mentor, and so I've been working with Sally ever since. So I've been working with anxiety disorders and OCD for decades.
Yeah.
As a clinician, I'm going to point something else out, which is another sort of concern that I have, which is, you know, in the diagnostic and statistical manual, DSM, they made the decision for scientific reasons to take OCD out of the anxiety disorders and put it into class itself, you know, OCD, BDD, BFRBs are in a category of their own. And what I've noticed over the course of my career, which I think is really good news, is that there are people that are OCD specialists and they treat primarily, if not exclusively, OCD. And I think that that's a fabulous resource and we need more of them. I think that somewhat of the downside of it is that those of us who were trained earlier when it was considered one of the anxiety disorders, I think that we had a more diverse training in terms of treating all of the anxiety disorders. We're exposed to, for example, the Barlow-Kraske panic control protocol, which is the gold standard for treating panic disorder. And sometimes I think that there's a tendency from people that are OCD specialists to sort of see everything through an OCD lens. And I think this is where education about anxiety sensitivity can be really, really important.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what anxiety sensitivity is. Anxiety sensitivity, it's basically, it's a trait that surprisingly seems to have somewhat of a genetic component, at least a familiar component, but there's some evidence that actually there's a genetic component. And it is the tendency, the proneness to see anxious sensations as being dangerous or harmful rather than just simply uncomfortable or distressing. Mm-hmm. You know, people, many of us know FDR's famous, you have nothing to fear but fear itself. Actually, that Henry David Thoreau was talking about fear of fear long before FDR was. There's a whole interesting history of phrase, fear. But, you know, but in a short way, it's the fear of anxious sensations.
Right.
And so what it is that it's a set of catastrophic beliefs about the nature of the experience of anxiety.
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, the good news is that while it's a trait, it is, in fact, modifiable, malleable with the right kind of treatment. And that's the really, really, really good news.
Well, and Carl, I have to smile a little bit because, again, and Sam, I was telling Carl, you know, in preparation for the OCRD series featuring emetophobia, I was talking with my husband this morning over espresso that we're going to be talking about this. His mother famously struggles. I say famously because she's been on the podcast talking about it, but she does struggle with emetophobia. And we were talking about the history of what used to be called and considered hypochondria in his family. And I said, what do you think is the biggest thing you've learned growing up? What's one of the biggest takeaways? And he quoted that FDR quote as well. He was like, well, the biggest fear is fear itself. And so you can see how this anxiety sensitivity, even in something like health anxiety, which is so common, right, plays such a major role and becomes such a strong feedback loop in terms of, oh my gosh, I'm sensing something. And now I'm interpreting, like you said,
this anxious sensation as a threat, as harm, as something more than just discomfort or distress. And anybody who's experienced it listening out there, it's not like a little discomfort. It is. It feels like a very overwhelming discomfort. But realizing that that feeling is indicative, or as we would say even in the inference-based world, irrelevant to any actual threat. But we apply a lot of meaning to it. And we go, well, shit, this means we're in trouble.
Yeah. And, you know, I just want to say that we use the word discomfort rather than danger. And by the way, that's a basic distinction is really highlighted by the work of the fabulous David Carbonell, who I think has the best workbook on panic, by the way. But Dave talks about this difficulty distinguishing between danger and discomfort. But that is not at all to minimize how painful the discomfort of anxious sensations can be. You know, and you just implied something really important, which is that this idea that if it's intense, it must be dangerous. And that the more intense it gets, that means I'm that much closer to dying, going crazy, losing control, that kind of thing. And intensity is not at all a sign of what's happening. It's dangerous.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Well, and you just punctuated a really important point that also comes up, whether it's been panic disorder, emetophobia, other things, other specific phobias, that idea that fear of losing control is so closely associated. I even have on my interest list of topics to cover this season a chat about POTS and the amount of people that think maybe I have POTS or maybe they have OCD. And that's, again, a subject for another day. But again, that sensation of, am I losing control? Am I having these orthostatic changes in blood pressure? What if it's both? It feels so dire. And we get a lot of people going through specialists and to cardiologists and into the emergency rooms with some of these features. And so, again, it gets really, really complicated. And I'm not insinuating that there's never any real underlying medical thing. I think often, especially when it comes to OCD, real event, you know, something you're actually experiencing amplified by the noise of the anxiety can become really tricky.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And there is, I think, when we talk about health anxiety, I think there actually is lots of research evidence that anxiety sensitivity plays a strong role in health anxiety. And so an anxiety sensitivity protocol combined with standard OCD treatment can be really, really helpful. So let me just say something about the whole issue of the fear of passing out, which is a very common fear.
Yeah.
And panic disorder.
Near syncope is what they call it if you're in the ER.
Yeah.
So ask me how I know.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. Why do people pass out? People pass out because their blood pressure drops. So what happens when you're having a panic attack? The sympathetic nervous system is very active and your blood pressure is actually going up.
Right.
Not dropping. So that's why you don't pass out from a panic attack. Now, by the way, that's not the same thing as passing out at the sight of blood and needles. That's something else. That's actually not panic disorder. That's something else. But, you know, there is in the literature such a thing as panic-induced syncope or panic-induced fainting. In my career, I have never seen it. And whenever a client has ever said, oh, yes, I did pass out, I did have an experience of passing out, there's always been another explanation other than panic. I got to tell you that that piece of information, again, back to the issue of comforting or reassuring information, can make such a huge difference for people. Now, of course, just the information is not enough. You need to then reinforce that with exposure, both intraceptive and in vivo, which we'll talk about more later. But again, there's the important role of the psychoeducational piece.
Yeah.
In terms of treating anxiety sensitivity. So let's talk about what anxiety sensitivity is not.
Yeah.
And it's often confused. Anxiety sensitivity is not the same thing as trait anxiety. Mm-hmm. And a common confusion that people have is that, I get highly anxious very easily. I'm so sensitive to threat that my threat alarm gets triggered at a very low threshold, I'm very sensitive. That's not anxiety sensitivity. That's something called trait anxiety. And while there's a connection between those two, right, it's not the same. Again, anxiety sensitivity is this secondary reaction to anxious sensations. That's specifically what it is. That has this, and this is so important, that has this self-amplifying, self-perpetuating loop that escalates into this intense experience. And for people that have panic disorder, that's what a panic attack is. A panic attack is always, always, always the catastrophic misinterpretation of a state of arousal. It's that you feel lightheaded, you feel pain in your chest, you feel depersonalization, derealization, you feel dizzy and vertigo, you feel rubber legs, you have all these sensations. No matter how intense those are, that's not a panic attack. A panic attack is, as Reed Wilson would say, it's always the secondary, uh-oh.
Right.
All right. That somehow this is dangerous. And then that creates this self-amplifying, self-perpetuating loop.
Yeah.
So let me just say that people that have panic disorder along with OCD, and they are fellow travelers, there's the statistics on it's anywhere from 15% to 50% of people with OCD also have panic disorder, that the central target for treating panic disorder is treating the underlying anxiety sensitivity. Let me make one more point. This is such an important idea. There is no such thing as an out-of-the-blue panic attack, right? You hear this all the time. Panic attacks are something that sort of comes out of the blue. But if you ever deconstruct a panic attack, what is happening is that there's a sensation that comes out of the blue. For me, suddenly I was feeling depersonalized, derealized, right? But that's not panic.
Right.
That's an anxiety reaction, or it could be from too much coffee, or it could be, you know, because you had a fight with your spouse, but that's not a panic attack. A panic attack is always, always the reaction to that sensation. So it's to what comes out of the blue. And by the way, that includes nocturnal panic attacks. Nocturnal panic attacks, like somebody with sleep apnea wakes up short of breath. But that's not a panic attack. It's then they say, oh, my God, I can't breathe. And then that creates the escalating.
Right.
Now, let me just, you know, this might be a good time to talk about this history of the concept of anxiety sensitivity. It was actually developed and identified by the psychologist Stephen Reese, who's a fascinating, fascinating guy. Unfortunately, Dr. Reese died relatively early.
Yeah.
He's no longer with us. But he, along with Richard McNally, introduced this idea about anxiety sensitivity in the mid-1980s. And there was a lot of pushback about it. And without getting into it, there was a lot of struggle between the cognitive therapists and the behaviorists. Not that that continues to go on to this day, but Reese talks about how he experienced a lot of resistance because anxiety sensitivity is fundamentally driven by cognitions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that, as we'll talk about, all right, it requires CBT, and there's a big C and a big B, mm-hmm. and proper treatment of anxiety sensitivity must include both. It's not just about ERP, all right? So I just want to give a shout out to another really important historic figure, which is there was an Australian physician by the name of Claire Weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us from the Jurassic period owe much credit to Dr. Weeks. I will tell you that Sally Winston identifies Claire Weeks as one of her mentors. And as early as the early 1960s, Claire Weeks was identifying this idea, the difference between first fear and second fear, which is another way of sort of understanding it, right? That there's the initial reaction to an external or internal cue, and then there's this secondary fear about it, again, that creates this spiral. So her books that have these tacky little titles, Hope and Help for Your Nerves, Peace from Nervous Suffering. But it is amazing how Dr. Weeks, long before the mainstream psychological community was talking about anxiety sensitivity, and there have been thousands of studies about it, she was a true genius. She was way before her time and was talking about this stuff in the early 1960s. And her books are still worth reading for anybody that sort of struggles with anxiety and panic.
Yeah.
So.
Would it be fair to say, Carl, I tend to write little chicken scratch notes as I have these conversations, and would it be fair to say that not all anxiety sensitivity is panic, but all panic is anxiety sensitivity?
That's exactly right, which then brings us to this idea, okay, is that anxiety sensitivity seems to be this trait, which is developed often early in life, and it predisposes us to a wide range of psychological problems. Mm-hmm. Underlying high anxiety sensitivity increases our risk for depression, substance abuse, or PTSD, and clearly for the anxiety disorders and OCD. In fact, there was a recent study by Krebs and colleagues who showed that adolescents with underlying anxiety sensitivity were much greater risk to develop obsessive compulsive symptoms, in their teenage years or young adulthood. And not only that, but that there's a reciprocal relationship between obsessive compulsive symptoms and anxiety sensitivity. They can feed on each other. We could talk about why that might be. And they then introduce a really interesting idea, which is that if we could identify kids and teenagers with underlying anxiety sensitivity and intervene with psychoeducation and other interventions, would that be protective against later developing some of these other disorders like OCD? It's a really, really interesting idea.
Yeah. Well, and as we've talked about here at the podcast, OCD is incredibly opportunistic. So you could see how if there's already a foundation for this spiral around anxiety sensitivity, even if it doesn't reach full-blown panic, but having that, what an opportunity OCD could take advantage, right? And so it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And one way of sort of understanding why they could be fellow travelers is that what often drives OCD is the misappraisal of thoughts. That, for example, if I have a harming thought, right, that must mean I'm dangerous, right? That's the misappraisal, that's the appraisal model of OCD, that everybody has these weird thoughts, as Robin pointed out in 78, and that what drives OCD is that misinterpreting and misappraising that this is dangerous. Well, you could see how much that parallels anxiety sensitivity, which is the misappraisal of anxious sensations.
Mm-hmm.
So this tendency to see our insides as dangerous, our emotions, our thoughts, our sensations as dangerous, may be this sort of common thread that drives all of this stuff.
Would you say another fellow traveler then with this, that again, it's not causal saying that one will definitely lead to the other, but can definitely be a fellow traveler, is then with these different phobic disorders, different phobias? Or would you say that feels separate? Because I feel like a lot of what's happening in that phobic fear is, okay, I have this initial response, but then I have that anxious response that says, okay, I'm in danger from whatever the thing is, pick a thing, spider, clowns, throwing up, things like that.
Well, sure. Yeah. But again, we don't want to confuse anxiety sensitivity with trait anxiety. So the tendency to have an anxious response to an external threat is not the same thing as anxiety sensitivity, although we certainly know that with OCD, there is tremendous, what's called comorbidity or co-occurring. All of the anxiety disorders tend to co-occur.
Travel with
OCD. Okay. Anxiety sensitivity, while there's this reciprocal relationship with OCD, it is not OCD.
Right.
And that the treatment protocol for anxiety sensitivity, again, while exposure is a really important part, ERP alone is generally not sufficient to treat anxiety sensitivity. It's really important to do the psychoeducation work and actually do cognitive disputation. And this is why it's important. Obviously, in OCD, we are not going to argue with whether or not there's Ebola on the doorknob, right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to do traditional cognitive disputation with obsession content, right? We know that that doesn't work. It can backfire. It can become a compulsion itself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When it comes to anxiety sensitivity and these beliefs that, for example, chest pain is a sign of a heart attack, we want to go after that, both with exposure as well as with cognitive work. Let me just say something here, for example. What you often hear, what people will say, I feel like I'm having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And we would take a timeout, just like an ICBT, we want to slow that down.
Right.
And we're going to say, wait a second. And we'll go back to the triangle, right, of mm-hmm. thoughts, feelings, and sensations. And
yeah.
what's actually going on? No, what's going on is you feel tightness in your chest, and you might feel short of breath, and your heart might be beating fast. And then the thought is, oh, what if I'm having a heart attack? And of course, if you think you're having a heart attack, you're going to feel fear, right? So that's where it's really important to sort of step back and identify the difference between thoughts, feelings, and sensation. Another one is with, you know, respiratory distress, which is a common symptom of anxiety and panic. And people will say, I feel like I can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you couldn't breathe, you would be dead.
Like
you do within 3 or 4 minutes.
Right, right.
What you're feeling is shortness of breath.
Right. Which is a sucky feeling.
Yeah. Which is a sucky feeling. It's often the result of hyperventilation.
Right.
Right. And actually, one of the things that I do with my clients is we'll intentionally hyperventilate. That's
right.
Interceptive exposure.
I've done that too, yeah.
Okay. Well, what I will also have them do is to wear a pulse oximeter that many of us have. We got one as a result of COVID, right, to actually check our oxygen levels. And when you hyperventilate, your oxygen levels actually go up.
Increase, right.
Increase. So you are in no danger of suffocation. In fact, the shortness of breath that we experience with hyperventilation and panic is a sign that our bodies are telling us that we are breathing too much, not too little. So it's our body trying to get us to breathe less, not more. And while I'm on this topic, I want to say something else,
yeah.
right? Okay. What is the problem with hyperventilation? There is so much misunderstanding. It is not the balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide, et cetera. Hyperventilation, the reason why it creates so many uncomfortable sensations, right, is the result of too little carbon dioxide in our body. Hyperventilation is breathing off carbon dioxide in excess of body need. And what happens is when the percentage of carbon dioxide in our blood goes down, our blood becomes alkalotic, and that creates many of the sensations. Again, it's incredibly uncomfortable. It's not dangerous. By the way, it doesn't make sense then if you're breathing too much to do deep breathing. That's another show. But that's another show, which is controversial and gets people out of their seats.
All the people that hate deep breathing are like, thank God.
Yes. All I can say is that if you've tried deep breathing when you're having a panic attack and it makes things worse, that makes perfect sense. Because if you're hyperventilating, what does that mean? It means too much breathing. So you actually want to decrease the rate and decrease the volume. So yeah. Anyway, that's another show, but I wanted to make that.
The theme here is like, can we just do story time with Carl? All these shows that we could do.
Okay. One more thing. So again, I want to emphasize, all right? Okay. Anxiety sensitivity is not OCD, and the treatment for them is different.
Mm-hmm.
So why else should we care about anxiety sensitivity when it comes to OCD? In addition to the fact that very often there's comorbid panic disorder and anxiety sensitivity predicts for all kinds of psychopathology, it also underlying anxiety. There was an important paper by John Abramowitz's lab. The lead author was Shannon Blakely,
mm-hmm.
that was published a few years ago, that showed that people with anxiety sensitivity had higher baseline OCD symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And predicted for a poorer outcome for the gold standard treatment, which is ERP. So why might that be? Why might anxiety sensitivity be a problem when it comes to doing exposure and response prevention? So let's say that you're doing an exposure to a contamination fear and you're, you know, touching the doorknob, right? That's going to evoke anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the fear of contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Very important part of treatment. But then there can be also this reaction to feeling anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And then the spiral that we've talked about, the self-amplifying loop. So people with high anxiety sensitivity, when they're doing exposure, they are dealing with actually two sources of distress.
Right.
One is whatever the OCD trigger is, and two is the internal experience of anxiety that they're then afraid of. And the article then raises the issue is, should we identify these patients and do a good anxiety sensitivity protocol, maybe even before exposing to OCD triggers, so that then people are not afraid of feeling anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why this is such an important
conversation,
you know, idea when it comes to treatment of OCD.
So when we think about then what is the protocol, I'm sure that people with bated breath, no pun intended, are like, okay, so what do we do with this? What is the protocol then for treating anxiety sensitivity?
The protocol for treating anxiety sensitivity is basically fourfold. And there was, in 2019, there was a book published by Smits and Otto and a couple others, which for the clinicians out there, I highly recommend the book. Everybody should have a copy. And they identify the four components.
Mm-hmm.
One would be psychoeducation.
Mm-hmm.
For example, some of what I just provided. And actually, it's not only psychoeducation, it's psychophysiological education. Oh, here's another interesting factoid.
Mm-hmm.
People often get afraid of the lump in their throat. Right. Mm-hmm. And a fear that they're going to suffocate from the lump in their throat. Well, what's actually going on? Well, I will show people a picture of the anatomy of their throat. Well, all it is muscle tightness. All it is.
Yeah.
A stiff throat is no different than having a stiff shoulder or a stiff neck, right? It's not like the muscles are closing in and squeezing off your trachea. Plus, the trachea, which, you know, the breathing, what brings oxygen down to our lungs and carbon dioxide out from our lungs, right?
Right.
Is this cartilaginous, it's made of cartilage, and this sort of idea that it can sort of easily collapse is just not the nature of it, you know. And then also people that are afraid to take pills, right? Many of the people in the OCD family have to take pills, and there are a lot of people that are afraid of taking pills. Well, the width of the trachea in women is about 0.9 inches. In men, it's a little bit bigger. It's about 1 inch. So the idea that there's this, you know, 1 inch tube that's going to get blocked by your Prozac just doesn't make any sense, right? Even if it were to go down the wrong pipe, right? So again, we want to provide people information. And
I would say acid reflux too can like create sometimes that burning sensation. People will say like, oh my gosh, is something blocked in my throat? And again, uncomfortable, absolutely, but different than actual threat, danger, which is what you're describing with the anxiety sensitivity that spiral beyond treat anxiety. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So the first part is psychoeducation, psychophysiological education. The second is actually cognitive work, identifying the catastrophic cognitions and really, really challenging them in a way that we would do with sort of examining the evidence, both from your own personal experience, from your own reasoning and common sense. And, you know, again, the kind of work that we wouldn't do in doing ERP with OCD, but is a really central part, right? Because we really want to identify and challenge the catastrophic cognition.
Can I ask a question? Would you differentiate that from what we define as inferential confusion? Or do you see it kind of as a Venn where they overlap? What do you think?
No. Inferential confusion in OCD is different. And a lot of people think that inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy, ICBT, is about arguing with obsessions and trying to talk people out of their obsessions. That's not what it is.
Right.
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 Right. We are not doing refutation. What we're doing is we're seeing how people argue themselves into the obsessional bubble, right? And to sort of catch those tricks and cheats of OCD about how we go through a reasoning process that puts us into the bubble rather than arguing with ourselves once we're in the OCD bubble. That's another show. But ICBT is not about disputation of irrational thoughts. Disputation of irrational catastrophic thoughts is part of treating anxiety sensitivity. And if you, for example, if you look in the Smitsonato book, they have a list of, when this comes to the next part, which is interceptive exposure. What they'll do is that they'll give an interceptive exposure exercise, like, for example, holding your breath to create a sense of pressure in the chest, putting your head between your legs as a way of sort of creating dizziness or vertigo, the intentional hyperventilation to create depersonalization, derealization, that breathing through a straw to create a sense of not getting enough of shortness of breath. These are all sort of regularly done. But if you look at the list, you will see next to it is the catastrophic cognition, the catastrophic belief that we are challenging with these interceptive exposure exercises. So you want to be doing both of those. In many ways, interceptive exposure, we could see those as being behavioral experiments. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of people doing ERP are probably like, I've done those types of exposures before. Yeah.
Yeah, but the intent here is not habituation. Let's,
anxiety,
you know,
right.
Let's habituate to the sensation, although that may be going on, but we're really doing this with the intention of creating this cognitive shift that what you're experiencing is not dangerous. And I will tell you something. Okay, what is also not part of the protocol is tolerance of uncertainty, which is maybe you're having a heart attack, maybe you're not.
Yeah.
You might do uncertainty exposure with ERP, right? That's not part of the protocol for anxiety sensitivity.
Right.
The other thing that's also not a part of the protocol is imaginal exposure. For example, somebody who has a fear of choking when their throat gets tight, we don't do imaginal exposure to imagining yourself choking to death. That's not part of the protocol. So again, while they are fellow travelers, the treatment for them are quite different.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, John Abramowitz's lab then, who is one of our colleagues, purports ERP wasn't indicated well for the anxiety sensitivity, and that would then make sense if we were just trying to habituate to the anxiety. If we were tolerating uncertainty, then it should work, right? But he's finding too, and you know, he's certainly an expert in our field, so.
Yeah, so then the fourth piece would be in vivo exposure, which is to take the learning from the
practice
of the interoceptive exposure and the cognitive work, and then apply that to the situations where people experience those sensations. So what that might look like specifically, so if somebody's afraid of their heart beating fast and feeling short of breath and sweaty, we might have them run up and down the steps or do jumping jacks, right?
Yeah.
And to really sort of tune into the sensations without doing anything. So you're exposing yourself to the sensation.
Yeah.
And sort of noticing that they harmlessly subside on their own without doing anything, right? And what happens is that if you don't add this second fear to the arousal, your body fixes itself in a relatively short amount of time. So then the question is that after doing this exposure, I will then say to a client, okay, I'm going to ask you a trick question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first thing is, what did you do to make yourself calm down?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is nothing. And we should probably sort of talk about what the role is of self-regulation in terms of anxiety sensitivity, but let's put that aside.
I'll make a note.
Okay. And then we'll say, so you had this experience of panic when you either touched a doorknob or you were in the grocery store or you had a fight with your spouse or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you another trick question. What's the difference between your heart beating fast here in the office with me versus your heart beating fast in those situations where you had a panic attack? And the answer is, there is no difference.
Mm-hmm.
But people will say, yeah, but what caused it is different because, you know, I was in the cereal aisle and suddenly my heart was beating fast.
Right.
That's true. While here, your heart was beating fast because you were doing jumping jacks or running up and down steps. But that's not the problem. Again, the arousal, the heart beating fast, the depersonalization, the feeling lightheaded, that's not the problem. The problem is the secondary reaction to it.
It's the context, the story.
And so what we want you to do is we want you to practice doing what you did here, which is nothing, waiting for the sensations to pass. We want you to do the same thing in the situations that evoke these sensations. Right. Mm. Here's another interesting factoid, right? What is the half-life of adrenaline? Like, how long does it take your body to metabolize a good portion of the adrenaline once it's released into the body? Like, for example, if I gave you an EpiPen and you hit yourself with a dose, how long does it take your body to metabolize it? And the answer is somewhere between 3 and 5 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say it's fairly fast.
It's fairly fast, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So once your adrenal glands secrete the adrenaline, all right, there's not a damn thing you can do. It's going to increase your heart rate. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's going to remind you of what it's like to face a real threat, an external threat, right?
Right.
But if you wait, it will subside in a relatively short amount of time. So if you're having a panic attack that's lasting for hours, there's something that you're doing to keep it going. What are you doing to keep it going? You're adding this second fear. You're adding this secondary reaction that's continuing your body to pump adrenaline.
Yeah, it's a fascinating way of thinking about it because, you know, for example, diabetics that may struggle with things like hypoglycemia, if they drink some juice or get some sugar and have maybe a glucagon shot nearby or something similar to the EpiPen for a reaction, it is pretty short, right? And we would say something where you may need an EpiPen, like anaphylactic shock or hypoglycemic reaction, can be life-threatening. And we can see how quickly an actual dire situation does die down. But many people will describe when having a panic attack, it can last for hours. And then they get the benzo or something and they go, oh, okay, now I can calm down. But what you're pointing to is actually physiologically, it's a fast process all around on how that metabolizes. What's different is the story, the catastrophe, right?
Yes.
That is
yes.
being held in the mind. And so if we're just going with the behavioral intervention, then we're missing out on what's keeping it relevant and at the top, at the surface.
Yeah. And I will say, what is the difference now versus the difference over 50 years ago when I was visiting my brother in a medical school? What's the difference now between back then? I mean, do I still get sensations of depersonalization, derealization, or feeling lightheaded or suddenly my heart races? Yeah. I mean, the diagnosis for that is that's life, right? But rather than the uh-oh that I did way back then and created this spiral, right now it's, so what? So what we're doing is replacing the what ifs with the so whats.
Yeah.
And in fact, a step further, Reed Wilson would say a step further would be, great, this is exactly what I need. Time to practice doing nothing, writing it out. Or even from a psychological point of view, I wonder why this is showing up now. Maybe there's some information in the fact that my body is reacting this way. But in any case, what recovery looks like is not the absence of these sensations, but as Claire Weeks would say, getting to the point where the sensations no longer matter. That's such an important.
You know, it's interesting because I'm thinking about with a client and we've been going through some of the RFERP framework for a case with emetophobia. And, you know, one of the distinctions that Dr. Michael Greenberg makes in his rumination-focused ERP, for anyone not familiar, RFERP is rumination-focused exposure and response prevention. one of the distinctions that he makes is between awareness and attention. Because I think sometimes people conflate, well, if it's still in my awareness, then I am engaging. And it's like, awareness is different. A lot of things are in our awareness that we're not consciously engaging with. And so really even getting to that point of being able to say, yeah, I'm aware that that sensation's here. There's nothing for me to do with it, is the difference.
Including I don't have to focus on, which is not the same thing as avoiding it or suppressing it or any of that, which is the, oh, yeah, there's that thing again. I can focus on the task at hand from an ACT point of view. I can focus on the valued action, and there's nothing that I need to do. I will say this, and this brings up an important point, which is I think that an acceptance-based approach to anxiety is, I think, the way to go, consistent with the anxiety sensitivity protocol, the panic control protocol, which are very, very similar. But I think sometimes a piece that's missing in acceptance-based work is to do the necessary work of sort of understanding that we can accept this, make room for it, because it's not dangerous. But if you believe that something is dangerous, it doesn't make sense to accept it. So right. I think the underlying cognitive work is often necessary in order to get to this acceptance-based approach. And this brings up another issue, which is learning self-regulation skills as a way of, quote, managing or decreasing your anxiety.
Yeah.
Like, for example, learning deep breathing or muscle relaxation or other emotion regulation skills. You know, this is sort of a controversial area because one person's coping skill or management skill can be another person's safety behavior.
Right.
I mean, is it possible to sort of teach self-regulation skills at the same time that you're doing this anxiety sensitivity work? Yes. I will tell you that I don't do it because I don't think it's necessary. And I think it can send a confusing message, which is that, okay, we want you to experience these internal sensations, but here's how to reduce them. Yeah, you could combine those two, but it gets muddy. That's a really good way to say it. So what I'll say to clients is, let's put the self-regulation skills off to the side. And what we'll do is, let me teach you how to not be afraid of this, and then I'll show you how to make it less intense. I will tell you that the research says, and this is an important point, that the research says that self-regulation skills don't really add much, nor they detract much to this fundamental work on, for example, on panic disorder, except for one safety behavior, which is really interesting, which is a coping skill or a self-management skill that does interfere with recovery, what's called other person safety behavior, which is, as long as this person is around, that I am safe, including my therapist, right? Because, I can do this interoceptive exposure exercise because if I, have a heart attack, my therapist will revive me or call 911. Now, what's interesting is that with teletherapy, that's less of an issue because I ain't going to be able to get to you if you have a heart attack or, but I think that what's really, really important is particularly for therapists working with clients or clients working with therapists, it's really important to sort of do this work on your own. That's why homework is particularly important. And the other thing is, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later, is for parents of anxious kids, is that you can, easily become the safe person for an anxious kid, and they'd never learn that in fact, that this anxiety, that they can manage the anxiety on their own, and most importantly, that this anxiety will pass.
Yeah, it's the difference between seeing you as an aid and a helper, like that example of if someone's using you as a crutch, but they're learning, I'm never going to be able to walk without this, versus using the crutch to help heal and have some support during that until they can be able to do this more independently on their own.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But what's really important is that after your ankle heals and you're still using a crutch, that's a problem.
Right? That is a problem. Yes. Yeah,
because you never gain the confidence and the belief that your ankle will support you without that crutch.
Yeah.
So that's a really good analogy.
Well, and my heart for, I'm just thinking as we're having this conversation about the neurodivergent a community. Because, you know, one of the points you made around self-regulation that I really appreciate is, like, it's a bit subjective. Like, what's going to be self-regulatory for me may function or could function more compulsively for you and vice versa. And so many people within the neurodivergent community have been told for eons here that the way they're processing the world isn't the accurate way or the proper way, the appropriate way. And so it does kind of create even things when we look at something like certain types of therapy, ABA and whatnot, it creates almost this kind of crutched system where it is other dependent. And one of the best things we can do, whether we're talking about anxiety sensitivity here or for the neurodivergent population, I really believe it's about self-advocacy and realizing what you need in that moment, being able to affirm that there's going to be different regulatory skills that help for each of us, but it has to come from you, not another person saying this should be the fix for you. It has to come from within you. So I know that it can also get into another topic for another day there, but I do like to acknowledge that often having in my mind these different intersections where this can pop up. And so it is really interesting when you look then at how interconnected the anxiety sensitivity is with these different relationships, whether it's with your therapist, whether it's a parent and child or a spouse relationship. Yeah. And of course, we have the family community listening here. And so what would you say is going to be most beneficial for people to support their loved ones going through this?
That's such an important topic. You know, there's some interesting research on this. And what we need to look at is not only the anxiety sensitivity in the child, but the anxiety sensitivity in the parent. First of all, what we know is that anxiety sensitivity in children, the fear of anxiety, increases the proneness to have family accommodation. And that makes sense, because the only way that I can stay safe from these sensations is to be close to my parent. And this is where space can be sort of so important, right? Which is to be able to send the message to the child that not only you can handle this, but we are not worried about you feeling anxious. Now, in terms of the parent's response, a parent's ability, and I certainly have seen this, I don't work with kids, but I do work with parents, anxious parents of anxious kids, is that there's also evidence that anxiety sensitivity in the parent increases the likelihood of family accommodation.
Yeah.
Because, of course, what is your number one duty as a parent? It's to keep your kids safe.
Right.
So if you see anxiety, not only in yourself, but anxiety in the other as being dangerous, then a responsible parent is going to do anything they can to keep their kids safe. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's when you end up with family accommodation. So this is why it's really important for parents with anxiety sensitivity to do their own work, right? So they're able to sort of know that their kid is not in danger. You know, and when you start talking about this with clinicians, or you even talk about this with kids, what they'll talk about is that, yeah, I'm getting to the point where I'm not freaking out when I'm anxious, but my parent is freaking out about me being anxious.
Right.
Right. And so it is really important. One way that I sort of sometimes, like, where do we learn anxiety sensitivity? It's an interesting question, right? How do we learn it? And sometimes I'll ask people with high anxiety sensitivity, is when you were anxious as a child and you put your anxiety out into the family, what you get back. And you may get one of two things. One is indifference, right? Or not noticing it, or an underreaction. And then there's, oh, hell, I'm all alone with this. But there can be something else, which is an overreaction to that.
Yeah.
Right? Which is driven by the parent's anxiety sensitivity. So, which is that, oh, I put anxiety out into the family, and what I got back was anxiety.
Right.
And what is that? That's anxiety about anxiety. And to some extent, it's interesting. Anxiety sensitivity can become sort of the internalized relationship.
Right.
I know this is getting a little object relation-y, but can be the internalized relationship between parent and child that, oh, what I learned is that my distress was distressing to my parent. And that has been internalized.
Yeah.
And as you say, threading that needle between being supportive, but at the same time, sort of knowing that your kid is safe, even though they're suffering,
yeah,
is really important. And sort of threading that needle. And this is why programs like SPACE are so important in terms of teaching kids.
It's a really great point. So some of the family listening might be, okay, so maybe I'm having an anxious response, or am I being under responsive? And they might be sitting there thinking, okay, what would be a good response to the anxiety that, say, in this case, the kiddo is emitting? How do we process through that that isn't under or over responding? And right. I get that this is a moving target because it depends on the person and it can be somewhat subjective what's too much for one versus another. But what would you say then, doing your own work around your own anxiety? So whether that's your therapy, SPACE, which you've described, is a protocol for parenting children with anxious childhood emotions. And so that's certainly a protocol that can be supportive. But in the moment, in the trench, you know, whether it's with a spouse or whether it's with a parent-child relationship, if you're not able to be like, hey, therapist, in this moment, which often they're not, right? Or in a program like that, what is a practical tool that someone can utilize to kind of zoom out in that moment and recognize perhaps that secondary anxiety that is being constructed? What would you say?
Okay. Well, we always, whenever we're dealing with anxiety sensitivity, we always want to come back to the mantra that this is discomfort, not danger.
Yeah.
This is not an emergency.
Yeah.
So if it's discomfort and not danger, right? Or another way of looking at it is that this is a false alarm.
Right.
My job is to slow myself down, and I don't have to sort of step in and fix this or rescue the kid. Another way is, oh, this is an opportunity for that fundamental learning to occur.
To practice, yeah.
The practice, which is that—
You don't have to do anything. Yeah.
We don't have to do anything. And this is where I think SPACE, again, is helpful, which is the message that parents are practicing is, I know this is hard, and I know you can handle this.
Right.
And we have the confidence that you can handle this. But I think this sort of fundamental shift to this idea that this is actually an opportunity for your child to do some important learning. And what we now know, since anxiety sensitivity is a precursor for all kinds of psychopathology later in life, this is really, really important work. Now, there's some really interesting resources working with anxiety sensitivity kids that are available. Maybe I could send you the link that you could put on the show notes. Including there's a free downloadable one about being a body detective, which brings up another point, which is that one of the best antidotes for anxiety is curiosity, right?
Right.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Look at that. Look at this sensation.
Yeah.
And let me notice how that feels, right? It's kind of a competing response to the, oh no, oh no, oh no, which is what drives the system.
Yeah, I would love that if you would shoot that over to me. And fam, as always, I'm going to have all the information about Carl and anything that we reference, book titles, etc., over at this episode's blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. So definitely check that out because, as you can tell, Carl is just a wealth of resources and knowledge. And as we kind of think about this, then we kind of circle back to something like we talked about at the top of the show with sensory motor OCD. And for folks unaware, more or less, there is that hyper attunement, hyper focus on one's bodily sensations, different sensations. You can see then how something like sensory motor OCD gets amplified with this traveler. They just go Thelma and Louise it over there, these travelers.
Yes.
And so it is absolutely important to not only look at what's going on within the behavior and how your body's responding, but understanding the bigger C, the cognitive process. I will say from anecdotal experience that I had an issue with this a couple years ago. It actually is what I've told the family here that I take medication. I started an SSRI, but part of what started it was having these different experiences where somewhat seasonally, I would start to feel a sensation that I had a bigger cognitive belief about that was going to be dangerous, a lack of control. What if somebody could get hurt? What if I'm driving and I have my kids in the car? Whatever the story is. And I would have these episodes balanced, near syncope, all of it. I've been to the ER. I've been to the cardiologist. We've tested it all. You know what changed it for me? And again, it's not that I never have a sensation where I'm like, that feels reminiscent of these times when I would have these balance episodes. But what changed for me was, what if this is really just the idea of this being a dangerous situation? And I follow the direct evidence around all of this that the doctors are like, you're good, girl. You know, there's no bigger problem that we can detect here. What if it's this belief that maybe this sensation or these episodes will never end, and it's a false belief?
Yeah. You know,
and that changed it for me. I have not had an episode. And again, that's not that I have never felt a feeling that feels like, ooh, do I feel like I have a low blood sugar all of a sudden or whatever the thing is. But it is so closely tied into what was that cognition that rooted in a secondary fear, because first came the feeling, the sensation, then came the thought. And so it's so important. And I say that I try to share personal examples when I can that kind of help apply it for family listening. But yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you're talking about. And so I think all of this is so, so very helpful. And anything else that you would want to share before you leave today?
Yeah. This is, here's another place where this is so important in the intersection between anxiety, sensitivity, panic, and OCD, which is that a lot of the more repugnant obsessions, like violent or sexual obsessions, there is an underlying fear of losing control.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
And very often what happens is when you're feeling intense anxiety is that your body feels out of control, right? I'm not able to sort of stop this escalating arousal, and that there's this sort of idea that if I can't control this escalating arousal, then who knows what else I might not be able to control, like control, you know, these fears of acting out violently or sexually. Right. So this is why it's so, so important, you know, to work on both of these things. I will say that if we look at the SUD scale, 0 is completely relaxed and 10 is the worst panic you've ever had. Right. One of the things I want people to take away with them, there is nothing after a 10. It's not 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Crazy, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Die, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Embarrass myself. Right. It's one of two things is going to happen when you get to a 10. You're going to stay at a 10 or you're going to come down.
Right.
Sooner or later, there is no such thing as a panic attack that never ends.
Right.
40 years ago, one of the first guys I ever treated for panic disorder started having panic attacks on a plane flight. It was a 10-hour plane flight. And, you know, he had not had treatment. So his shirt was soaking wet. He was exhausted. He was hyperventilated, et cetera. What happened to him? The answer is he fell asleep eventually.
Right.
He used up all of his adrenaline and he was so exhausted that he fell asleep.
Crashed,
I'm sure that when he woke back up, he probably started panicking again. But that's the sort of idea, right? That panic attacks, intense anxiety always, always ends. And what keeps it going is the fear that it's never going to end.
Yeah. You know, Madison will talk and has been on the podcast talking about this, about how that was core to her DPDR, was that feeling that it's not going to end. I would also say some of my OCD clients that have more disgust-based triggers, disgust-based fears, there is the disgust issue, but secondary to it is that anxiety sensitivity of, what if I never stop feeling disgusted? Right?
Right.
And so it's also, I'm just thinking about it in terms of that framework. Often the lack of control, this might never end and it might never stop, is attached so strongly, that cognition right there, to the perpetuating engagement with the problem.
Right. And again, there's that secondary reaction to it, which again is not to minimize the pain, the very real pain, the real aversiveness of having a strong disgust reaction, the same way of having a strong shame reaction or a strong fear reaction. what's so, so important about this is when we talk about this, this is not at all to be dismissive about somebody else's suffering. And it's important to sort of not get that message. When we say getting to the point of sort of so what, it's not so what about your discomfort or pain. It's so what about the consequences of it.
That secondary fear. Yeah.
That secondary fear. And one of the things that I really like that we've done today, and I've really tried to discipline myself here, and it's just semantic difference, which is that we made a distinction. We have not used the word symptom once.
It's true.
We've talked about sensations, and I've really sort of made this an important practice for myself in terms of working with myself and working with my clients, right? A sensation is just a body event. A symptom is a sensation plus a story.
Mm-hmm.
They are not the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Right? Chest discomfort may or may not be a symptom.
Right.
Right. But the chest discomfort itself is not a symptom. It's a sensation.
Right.
Right. And most of the time, in a particular context, it's just a sensation that will come and go. In the same way that when you hear a noise in your house, a sensation is like noise. And then the question is, when you hear a noise in your house, what is the point at which you decide that you need to take action?
Right.
Right. As opposed to, oh, yeah, that's just the HVAC going on and off. That's the creaking of the old house, et cetera, et cetera. If this is a noise that I have to take seriously, it's got to be intense, novel. And let me also say this. If there's a new sensation that you're getting, there's nothing wrong with going to the doctor and getting it checked out, right? That is not a compulsion.
Right.
There is nothing wrong with sort of checking out a sensation, particularly a sensation that doesn't subside, a pain or an ache. There's nothing wrong with that. It only becomes a problem when you go to the doctor and your doctor reassures you.
Yeah.
And then, but maybe they're missing something, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's when it becomes problematic.
Yeah. Right.
So.
Well, and that's just a pitch for following the direct evidence as well, right? Because if you go to the doctor and the doctor says you're good, you're good. We're not minimizing that heart attacks have angina associated with it being the chest pain, or that anxiety and panic can also have chest pain. And so I think it's such an important point to say, like, okay, if you're having something new and you don't have other evidence for it and you want to have that checked out, great. Absolutely. You can have that checked out. But just the presence of pain, just the presence of discomfort, just the presence of anxiety, just the presence of fear in and of itself does not tell us anything other than it's there.
Yeah.
And so often I will say this to myself, and it kind of just goes back to that point that we can be aware of it, but don't have to engage. I will often say, you know, whether it's around different physical sensations or something else, even out loud sometimes to myself, Nicole, you don't have to do anything with this. Yep. Okay. And there's nothing to do with it, because often it's our doing, it's our engagement with that fear. Then it just continues to grow. Then it can become so much more. And so that's the difference between the 3 to 5 minute metabolization of that adrenaline and the 4 hour panic attack where you're feeling immobilized.
Right. Right.
Excellent. Well, Carl, this has been a treat. I have really enjoyed this conversation, and I think this is going to be very, very helpful for so many people. And again, it extends beyond OCD, but we can see the usefulness and the utility of it within OCD as well. So we really appreciate your time, as always. So glad to have you back. I'm sure it won't be the last time, Carl, because I do think maybe we need a story time with Carl's like, but that could be fun.
I so enjoy our conversations, Nicole, and thank you for all you do for the community. And I look forward to doing this again down the road.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you as well for all you've done. And he's so smart, isn't he, guys? He's just like so knowledgeable. So thank you. Appreciate your time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for that. Okay, fam.
What a great conversation. Seriously, when Carl first proposed this topic for a possible pod, I knew it would be such a helpful discussion because Carl has such an approachable and helpful way of helping others understand concepts better. And the expanse of his mind, y'all, with books and journals and research studies, it's amazing. So thanks again to Carl for a fantastic and helpful discussion on anxiety sensitivity. And that brings us to my intrusive thought segment, which is my application segment of the show for any newer fam joining us. It's where we take what we've heard and we brainstorm ways we can apply it here and now. And one of the things I was thinking about from our chat with Carl is that we really are strong, fam. We are. I'm strong, you're strong, our partners are strong, our children are strong. Surviving OCD or panic disorder, agoraphobia, you name it, they're no joke. Thriving through anxiety sensitivity, that is hard. But if I could, I would challenge you to be curious together this week. In thinking about the space protocol we discussed, one of the things we do is we make this announcement and we affirm that we're strong and we've got to give ourselves more credit than we have been that we can get through these sensations. Because my guess is a lot of us are stronger than we get credit for. But also, we are tough. And even if we doubt our ability to do it, our family is that mirror on the wall that often can reflect back strengths or maybe when we've bit off more than we can chew. Discomfort has not earned the status, nor is equal to danger, particularly when we think of conditions like panic or even within OCD. So what makes you tough or strong? Think about it. Talk to your family about it. Just like I'm going to talk with mine as I welcome my three little helpers fresh out of the gate on their Christmas break.
Hi, my name is Jack. I am the eldest child of Nicole.
Good job, babe. Okay, so here are the questions I'm going to ask you. What's one thing you wish we knew more about your thoughts or feelings?
That's a good question. Some stuff like that I see in like videos, some of those things I would just not be scared about. But I think there's like a teensy weensy more of a chance that I'm kind of actually going to be scared of it if I had to do it in person.
Yeah, good job. Emma?
That I want to be kind to everyone.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Lukey?
Can make my feelings better.
I like trains.
Oh, I love it. Next question. How tough are you?
I am super tough. 100 strong.
100 strong. What made you 100 strong?
Like challenging that I can even pull some heavy stuff and I'm so strong and have 100 weight. I practice to get stronger and eat healthy food because you don't have energy.
Oh, gotcha.
Emma,
really tough.
Yes, you are really tough. Jack.
Oh, I try really hard on things.
Ooh, so you're pretty tough. Are you strong?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you're definitely strong. I like that. Emma, what makes you strong?
Eating fruits and vegetables. Yep.
Thanks, Emma. Jack.
My confidence.
Ooh, I like that. That's wonderful. Good job. Thank you.
Welcome. Merry Christmas and a happy new year to all. Merry Christmas.
Oh my gosh. All right. I'm biased, fam. I know. But they're the best. They are the best. I love them. And if you've ever done ERP, again, that's exposure and response prevention for OCD, you might have empathized with Jack's vibe about how watching videos is a little less scary than practicing different things IRL. That is definitely a nod to ERP there. But what we've also learned is in this home, we don't have to be scared of being scared or strong. And I know as mom, even though it hurts to see when he is scared, it pains me that I don't have to be scared of him being scared, of him having sensations and pausing, zooming out and recognizing that that secondary fear is really that swelling story around the original sensation that has created this lingering distress. So whether you or someone you love is struggling with anxiety sensitivity or not, I want you to pause, take note. Label the sensation you're feeling, and then let's take a page out of Carl's book and remind ourselves, this is a sensation, not a symptom. Because sometimes in life, practicing the so what's are key. So happy holidays, fam. From this family, the OCD family community, to yours. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Carl Robbins and me breaking down anxiety. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment? Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.